really have the standing as kind of one of the most substantial.
I don't think there's any doubt. There's people who say that he saved the bank, and I don't know what they would have done. I know when I heard people, these people that we had made the list for to go out and see, they looked at him. They told me that afterwards. It's a good thing they brought Frank Green. Axel Bowman was not a popular man. Ole Bowman was popular. He was kind. He was not a banker, but he was respected, yes, but he was destitute, and you can imagine a man going out with his feeling when he went to get this money, because it looked bad for him. It was his reflection. Will you come to my rescue? That's just exactly what he was trying to say, but he didn't. He didn't do the talking. He probably did the nylon. Axel was a talker. He probably did the talking. Ole stayed in the background because he felt that my days are over, see. And he never was the same man after that either. He was disheartened. He had lost all he had built. But he snapped out of it pretty good, because it was so successful. It started with a bang again, and everything fell in its place. Sure, there was loss. There was a loss, but you just as well forget it. He hated Wheeler. He hated the bank examiner, and of course, he had to blame somebody, which was natural. I didn't. I looked at it from the other side. Well, that if it wouldn't have been Wheeler, it'd been somebody else, and it could have been worse.
What was that saying that I remember reading? Something like the bank examiner Wheeler said, "Well, we cleaned up a lot of paper," and Ole Bowman said, "Yeah, at my expense," or something.
Yes, that's how you always felt. See, but well, we did get it back, and the new people who put up the money, it was business. He had no choice. He had 70 shares. That meant he was to go out and find 70 shares at $250 a share. That was $17,500. You know, that was a fortune in those days. That was unbelievable. He cashed in his life insurance. That was the means that he had to do it. He cashed in his life insurance. I don't think he sold any land, but in order for him to save what he could, he saved every share of stock that he could raise and pay the $250 assessment on. He tried. He did everything in his power, and when he got through, well, then the rest of them divided up among W.A. Keeney, among John Nyland, among Mons Johnson, and among Eliph Johnson, that's 4. Carl Johnson is 5. Albert Lewis is 6. And Frank Green is 7, and myself was 8. There was 8, and Ole Bowman was 9. And I can't remember that there was another person. But in other words, Ole was first. He got whatever he could stand, and the rest was divided up. And you paid $250 for every share. I set it to raise the $50,000.
Before you go, I was going to ask you about Mr. Green. Did it take him? Was he here from the Waverly days and established in his business?
He came from Kansas. I can't remember for sure how old he was. He homesteaded, didn't he, out here on the Berridge?
Yeah. Yeah, he settled on Little Berridge. He had not the Stanley Hilliard place, but the one right below it there, somewhere. He had one, maybe it was the Leonard Nelson place. But it was out there on the ridge where he homesteaded.
Did you ever know how what his connection was with this country that he came? Did he know anybody that was around here?
No, there were several brothers that came from Canada. They had a connection in Canada, didn't they?
Well, he had family in Canada. He had two brothers in Canada. I can't remember whether Dad was the first one or his mother and dad came from Virginia.
But they were out here as well?
Yeah.
And around Troy? Mm-hmm.
But I can't remember.
Well, he's supposed to be related to what history?
Oh, his mother was related to Lee.
Yeah, Lee, the General Lee.
Second cousin.
Yes. So they were their Virginia old.
We used to brag about it, go to school when we were in high school up here, and go up and brag about our famous relative. And Dad said, "You have got some that were hanged too, so don't go bragging about any of them, because you have some infamous ones too."
Did he move into Troy when he started the roller mill?
He farmed, didn't he, out there?
Yes, he farmed, and he owned the farm. I don't know that he lived up here on the farm. This first house you go after you get up from top start down, that's the old family farm too. Marge has a third interest in that. But he farmed there, and then he moved to town here. Then you were born next door here.
Yeah, I was born in this house next door.
He married a gal that was 16 years.
Yeah, they eloped from out on Bear Ridge with the horse and buggy with my grandmother. I don't remember for sure whether it was my step grandfather or my.
No, it had to be your grandfather.
Was
no.
Alive then. Hot in pursuit of him.
But he got away.
Dad was almost 20 years older than my mother. They made it.
Yes, they lived.
They had to go to Moscow probably mm-hmm. to mm-hmm. get to justice. Yeah. Well, I wonder how he got into. The roller mill. How
well, that's quite a history in itself. See, he must have had the roller mill. Did he have a roller mill? Where'd you ever hear that?
And that's what I thought that's what it said in the First Bank of Troy.
Did he ever have a roller mill?
Flour mill.
It was a flour mill.
Well, then that was that building right down there then.
Then he was over here though, too.
No, but he bought this from Duthie. See, they went to Spokane. I've heard him tell about that. There was a motor company there. That's when the transport motor truck was starting to be manufactured. And he and Harry Driscoll and August Johnson went to Spokane into that business. They bought, they formed a corporation, and they went into the business together, all three of them. Green was a silent partner. He didn't go up. I don't know whether he was in business in the grain business then or not, but anyway, they started this business, and then they broke up, and August Johnson took the motor company himself. Harry Driscoll ended up with the Idaho Bean, and Frank Green continued on in the FM Green Grain Company. So that was his sideline. But don't any of those history books give much detail of his life?
I don't think so.
They just tell us. See, he was county commissioner for years.
Oh.
And a lifelong Democrat. And
32nd degree Mason.
Yeah.
Was he a Democrat because he'd come from the South?
Probably, although I don't know. He fought in. He was in the Idaho State Militia. I know because when they had the uprisings in the mines, I heard him tell about that they were called out and he had to go up and.
Did he ever tell about what happened to him up there?
No. No, I think it was just them. It was just the same as they called it the militia, and now they call it the National Guard. And I think all they had to do was keep order, and that was the size of it. That was when the IWWs and the miners were striking and so forth. But I don't think there was any lives lost or anything like that.
But he made his wealth just on his company.
He made his wealth, obviously. He was wealthy before he must have got into grain business. I think he was a conservative man that made money and was able to take care of it. You know, that's how the old generation did it. They had taken care of it was the main thing. But he stretched the old dollar. And he got
mostly by farming, didn't he?
I would say so, yes, the early days. Just clearing land and selling it. And branching out. And now I know the place that the Cornwall place that he got, which was 160 acres, he financed the purchase of a of the Hulk, of do you, have you interviewed Oscar Hokanson? Does that name ring at all?
No, I know who he is.
Okay, all right. His dad bought the place for $8,000, just 160, and Frank Green gave him the $8,000 to buy it. He went down there, and he lasted about 4 years, and he couldn't even pay interest. And so Andrew come to him, well, I just as well deed it to you. He says, I can't make it, you can have it. Frank Green says, okay, and he took it. And then he bought 40 acres from the Cornwall estate after that. So it's 200 acres out there. I know that's how he got that. But up here, I imagine he just naturally bought that from over a period of time. I don't know how he got it. But doing the grain business, it was fabulous. He was just like everybody. That office was always full of, they'd stand there and talk. And he was not a talker either. He was a quiet, reserved man, but his advice.
But he was sure good with young people.
Yeah, he could, and he was on the school board for years. But he would tell you, and it just seemed to be golden information. And a great advisor to his people, his customers. They all swore by him, you know. And of course, he would carry them. He'd give them their seed. He just was more or less Santa Claus.
He's mostly so when he bought the store.
Well, and that was the worst deal he ever got into.
Put me in as manager after he couldn't stand the whole thing. It's in there, and I've never had anything to do with the store in my life.
Which store was this?
That's where the bus garage is.
Was this the one you mentioned to me once Primark, in the 30s when with the script on Roush's?
Yes, mm-hmm. That's right.
You managed the store?
Yeah.
If you could call it that.
You wouldn't call it that.
No, that was a job.
She managed it. She did a good job, but it was such a job because everything was credit.
Everything.
They all knew Frank Green, you know, and he had money. So I can't pay, you charge it. And that's the way it was.
Thick.
Yes, sir. Everybody charged, and he did well. He and Ole Bond had it together, actually. He and Ole were 50-50.
Well, did they expect to make money on it?
They were more interested because the store went broke. That was Williamson. The store went broke, and the bank had a bad note.
Furniture, shoes.
Yeah, groceries. You got a department store,
dresses,
boy. You could
everything.
Buy anything and everything.
Was that the same Williamson as was in Moscow?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Williamson,
yes, yes.
He
came down here and he ran Williamson's department store, and he went broke during the 30s. And the bank had a note, and just for the end, and so that's how Ole got involved, and said, well, let's take over the assets for the note, because I think he paid all the creditors but the First Bank of Troy, and so I don't think they ever did pay the note, but anyway, he and Frank Green started, they each dumped in, I think, each $2,000 in a pot. And that started the store. And heck, fire, they did a good business.
What kind of recovery was there on all those?
Well, the Green and Bowman, I don't think they lost anything. They didn't make anything, but when it was all over, I don't know whether they fully recovered their original investment. I doubt it. I think they just forgot it. But
you say it was kind of a mess.
It was poor times. See, the Depression wasn't over yet.
It must have helped this town keep going.
That was what they had in mind, was to, because this, they wanted a store. It was a great thing. That was when the Saturday nights was fabulous.
And
Saturday nights?
Stay open till 12 o'clock at night. And your store would be so full of people. It would be just like a 4th of July. Every Saturday. You couldn't even, I think I wrote in that thing I gave you that you couldn't find a place to park on Saturday night.
That's right.
That was the truth. You couldn't. And I worked in the store on Saturday nights.
Oh, really?
Yes, I'd help clerk, and we have a great time. We had the CC camp out here. And I'll never forget. You remember the kid that had he had a coat on, and and I noticed it was bulging, you know. And I happened to look in there, and I could see color. And I pulled it back, and he had about 24 ties in it. He was stealing them, see. And I reprimanded him. I said, "Young man," I said, "I'm not going to do anything, but you better not be caught in this store again." And he pulled them all out and laid them on the counter, and out the door he went.
Did you ever tell him about the gypsies?
No, that would be Bertel Bowman, huh?
Yeah.
Well, I wasn't in on that. I can tell you gypsy stories, though.
Bertel Bowman, and what they do to him, I don't know, but
they
open the cash register for him. And about the time they reach in, well, then he'd shut it. I don't think they ever got anything out, did they?
I don't know,
well,
but
they
don't trust him.
Ways of getting
it's dynamite. Yeah, I'll tell you one. When I first went in the bank, Kendrick, and this cashier of this bank was shrewd. He was a Jew, and he was good, but he couldn't conceive that any gypsy could ever get the best of him. And of course, you didn't. They were so rare that you just. He thought he was having a good time with the old biddy, the old squaw. Anyway, she had him to where he was putting $20 bill out on the counter, and he had two of them out there. And they were manipulating, and finally he quit. He said, "I've had enough." So he put them back in the drawer, and that night we were $20 short. And so help me. You know, he knew that old gal got it. It's just as sure as a dickhead. I don't think he slept for a week. And he didn't make any bones about telling us about it, but he was manipulating. And we had a cafe down at Kendrick, George and I. We operated a cafe, and they came in. And they got me to open the till, too. But she was out, and I wouldn't let her get to it. And she'd take my hand, she says, "Now hold my hand on my breast, you know, just like that, you know." She's a great big old thing, like that. And she had me going, too, but the minute she was stepped toward, it was behind the counter on the confectionery bar. So, and the minute she'd take a step, I'd close it and I'd push her back. And finally, I got so scared that I said, "You get out," and she did. But they had young girls running around the store. You don't know what they stole. They probably took every candy bar they could get their hands on.
And
I was there alone.
It has to do with telling your fortune. At least that happened to a friend of mine not too long ago in the city. You know, telling your fortune, that's how you lose.
Yeah, well,
or blessing your
that's
money.
Right. Sure, blessing your money. That's how they get sight of it. But it's, you know, I'll tell you one. And this actually happened too. George, my brother, and I told you in that letter how we'd go home, and if you ran into them, why, the mothers, the parents, they always warned us, don't get near them because they steal boys and girls. And we were told that, and literally talked. But anyway, George and I was alone in the camp right below. Where we went up the hill to our farm, and just off the bridge a ways was a nice little camping spot toward at the head of the grade there. And this was in the toward, it was still daylight. And so George wanted to go down and talk to him. And I didn't want to, but I wasn't going to let him go alone, so I kind of followed behind. And they came out, and there's two older men. And so they started questioning George, and they said, and they started telling us, "Well, we like boys like you. We could take you along, you know, and this and that." And they were just kidding. And so they said to George, "How far is it to the next town?" And he was a smart, alecky guy, you know. And he said, "Well," he says, George said, "it depends on how you travel." He'd been in a play, and this was part of the play. "Depends on how you travel." And they said, "Well, how's that?" And he said, "Well, if you walk, it's a long ways. If you ride, why, it's not too bad. You get there." But he says, "If you go in an airplane, you're practically there now. But if you'd have gone by telegraph, you'd been there already." And the old gypsy looked at him. He said, "We don't want any of that, boy. You go on home." It happened. But he was a talking kid, you know. Dad always out of time. George keep his mouth shut. He was a politician in the family. But that just about floored the gypsy. You're on the telegraph, you'd have been here already. But he learned it in a play at school.
Yeah.
And he pulled that on the gypsy.
I think usually they're the ones that get the best of you. Probably not.
Oh, they were. Yeah, they didn't steal kids,
yeah,
really.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, but it would be, that was a way for the parents to scare the kids that they don't get near them, because they would be friendly. Gypsies were friendly. I don't care whether you were a kid, but oh, how they'd steal chickens. That's what they would come to your house in your yard, see? And when the men would come to the doors, and the women would get into the chicken houses or get into the grain bins, they'd steal, they see their horses, they'd steal oats, they'd steal anything they get their hands on. Oh, it was awful. But you never knew when they were coming. The only way is if they come to one house and then the parent, they call the next ones, go out and shut the pasture gate. And stand out there and just tell them that you don't want anything, keep on going. That was common. But if you let them in near your house or in your barnyard, they would load their wagons up with grain or feed or anything to get their hands on. Steal, steal, steal. And some of the women were really attractive, as I recall. But they were dirty, that is, they weren't well-dressed or anything like that.
You know, you're talking about before some about town life, you know, in the 20s. And this store being open at night reminds me of that. I was thinking, we talked a little bit about the dances and about a little bit about the bootlegging, but what did kids do? Like, when you were dating with Mrs. Rocker, you know?
Well, of course. She taught school, and of course you might say she came home only every other week or whenever it was. But we went to dances. We went to dances a lot. We never missed, and after we got married, and even before, we never missed a movie in Moscow. We always went to the movies. There wasn't a bad one ever, you know. There never was a bad movie in those days. They were all good. But we'd go to the movies, we'd go to the dances. We had a dance hall here, we had one in Helmer, so there was dancing. And there was plays, there was Chautauquas, or you put on a play yourself, that was common. I'd say that was, and of course, I had a car, so you would go or park or whatever you did, and you could go out into the rural. Every community had a schoolhouse, and they'd have some nights they'd have a dance, and they advertised that, and you would go.
Was it very different in the country than in town, as far as the,
no,
the dances?
No, I wouldn't say that. Your country dance would be strictly private. That is, it'd be local people. In the dance hall at Helmer, the dance hall here at Troy was countywide. They'd come players from Lewiston, and you'd see Pullman people, you'd see Genesee people come to the Allens dance hall in Troy, and Moscow and so forth. And the same way at Helmer. Helmer attracted them from Moscow and Pullman and Genesee all over. And that was a big affair. Shoot, there'd be 200 people dancing at a time. It'd be crowds, you know. It was a mammoth hall.
Are you talking about the place at Helmer?
Yes.
I was just talking to the Lawrences when they were up visiting recently.
Yes, I can remember that.
They were telling me about that, running that place.
They
really had affairs out there.
Yeah, it was a fad. It lasted so long, and then when it blew up, it really blew. But of course, the Depression is what killed it, because you catered to moonshine. It was operated during the moonshine days. That was minor, but you never went to Helmer, but you had a good time. And as soon as 12 o'clock came, that's when they had to stop, and they went to roller skating. And you'd roller skate till 2 and 3 in the morning. I have gone, Marge and I have gone to Helmer with a party. It'd be about 3 and 4 couples of us. We'd never go to bed. That was after married. We'd take off as soon as the dance was over, and nobody in our particular party liked to roller skate. We were old, as the fellow said, that was mostly for the teenagers or the half-drunks. But anyway, one family lived in Clarkia, that's Walt Johnson, he lived in Clarkey, and he was working for the forest there, so they had a house. So we got in the car and we drove to Clarkey. Well, it'd be getting to be daylight, so you wouldn't even go to bed. You'd get breakfast and then you'd go on out and start fishing. You'd go fishing for the rest of the day. That's the life of it. It was fun. You thought nothing of it.
That sounds great to me.
That's right, yes. Yeah. But you made your own fun. There was plenty of opportunity you could do, but it took somebody. It took friends. In other words, if you were loners, and you didn't run around with anybody, I would say it would be tough, because there was just you either went. When Helmer was good, there was no dance hall of Troy. It seemed as though when that started dropping down, then the one was built here on the same pattern, the same sort of a deal as the one Helmer. Well, that lasted for about 4 or 5 years, and that was good. And so it would shut down for maybe 2 or 3 months, and somebody would come along. Alan from Lewiston, who was a band leader, and he had his band, he'd come up and he'd say, "Al, I'm going to try it again." And money was tight, money was scarce, and it was still moonshine days. There was no liquor by the drink yet. That was still in the late 29s and 30s. See, their liquor didn't come till 34, over the counter. So I was doing that lull, and the moonshine, it was tragic, because when you bought moonshine, you drank it. And you didn't throw it away, and you didn't take it home. You didn't dare have it. You had to drink it. And so consequently, they drank it, and they got drunker in hell, because they had to get rid of it. That was the bad thing about it, see, because they were tough. There was law enforcement. There was squealers all around you. guys, it was stool pigeons, they called them,
That really was a danger.
Yes, it was. Mm-hmm. You just didn't go out and drink with a stranger, because you didn't know about what he was setting you up. He could blackball you. Nothing else.
He could blackball you?
Yes, he could say, we'll have a bottle, we'll have a drink, and then the third guy would come, see. His pal would come up and grab the bottle, and you would disappear, see, and you'd be standing there with a bottle. You'd be innocent. You thought you were drinking with a friend. That's how they pin it onto you. And then, in order to save your reputation or your name, my golly, you'd slip in $100 or whatever. He said, "Well, forget it. It stunk." But those are the hazards of it. And then to drink more than you could take, I always got sick. I couldn't really drink so much. I wouldn't let myself. And much whiskey and much moonshine as I had, I never got drunk. Because I always got sick before I get drunk.
I heard that stuff was strong.
You couldn't drink it straight. You had to always cut it. You got a bottle of moonshine. Probably a third of it was moonshine. The rest would be ginger ale. Or, I don't know. I've drank it with milk even. And put some, milk, and cold milk wouldn't be bad. And I think, not ketchup, but what's tomato juice? Mm-hmm. That was common. And of course, it was good because it helped your stomach. Mm-hmm. But I drank my share of moonshine. But you always wanted to get good. There was so much talk. Newspapers was constantly publishing the loss of sight and people dying from moonshine, bad moonshine. So you all were awful cautious of whose you bought. I've gone out here toward Randall Flat, and you would send word out, or you would tell him, "I'll meet you here next Friday night." You always wanted your moonshine for Saturday. And they would deliver it at night, and you'd say, "I'll meet you at such and such a corner." And my friend would go out there as far as we go with the car, and he would meet it. He'd be there waiting. And you'd drive up, and then you'd pay him $2.50, $3 for a pint. And that pint went a long way. It could, let me try, because you could cut it, see? You could make that pint into, well, whatever you wanted, but you didn't dare keep it around. You had to dispose of it. You had to either give it to somebody else and say, well, and I never sold any in my life. But you had to dispose of the evidence. So you drank it, and as a rule, you'd do your drinking before you, when you left your house, in your home, see? And then you'd go to the dance, and then you drank enough that that lasted in there else. And there was always some wise guy out there that would have a bottle on him that was or hid out there, and you'd go outside. But as a rule, you had a good time, and you didn't have to be drunk to have it either.
You didn't take a chance to drink take your bottle.
No, sir. You never saw a bottle in sight.
And you always buy it really out.
You bought it away. Yes. Of course, there was bootleggers that would be at the dances, and but you had to know who they are. And they had to know you, or you'd have to take somebody with you that knew. But we never made that a practice.
Mm-hmm.
We did our drinking in our home, and we left. We'd leave Troy, say, at 9 o'clock. We'd get to Helmer maybe by 10 or 9:30. You danced till midnight, and you still felt good. It didn't take much to get you. And we were amateurs from the standpoint that we weren't heavy drinkers or hard drinkers, but you...
Did any of the girls drink then?
Yes, but politely. You'd never see one, once in a while, but you'd take one drink, or two drinks, they might take one, but they were light, and it didn't take much, but they didn't, as a rule, it was too strong for them. Most of them, they couldn't stand it. It was hot, boy.
What was it that you mentioned to me about the guy that, now, it was the guy that had been the doctor. He's the guy that was your family's doctor.
Well, no. Our regular family doctor contacted the, got sick just before he got the flu.
Oh.
And so he became incapacitated. And so in the midst of the epidemic, lo and behold, here this Dr. Kelly came into being. Who told him or what brought him to Kendrick, I don't know. But he had a horse and a buggy, and of course we had the telephone, and when our family became sick, he would cover a ridge at a time. In other words, he'd come up in the morning, he'd see all the flu patients in the area, and then he would go back, and then the next morning he'd go to the other ridge, and he was doing that. You probably could never get him unless there was an emergency, only about every third day, because he had to cover a terrific territory, and he was alone. And he got by because he was a doctor. He professed to be a doctor. But anyway, he doctored us, and all he did was give the pills, and there was no science to it. There was not a heck of a lot you could do for flu. It's a dirty shame they didn't have whiskey, because I was told that was one of the difficulties of the flu epidemic, that they had whiskey. It would have done stimulation to your heart. Your heart enlarged, see, and if you were a heavy, husky person, the flu was much harder on you than a skinny one, because he had more room in there. But anyway, that's irrelevant. But anyway, after it was all over, people, they called him a horse doctor, they began to realize that he didn't do anything, and yet, when it was all over, you got the doctor bill, and you paid him, and a lot of people just said that he was a horse doctor. He had no certificates, no license, and he had no office. So he hung around Kendrick, though, because he got to know quite a few people, and he got intimate. And Dr. Rothfeld went out of the business. That was the old family doctor, so Kendrick had none. So he kind of hung it out. And lo and behold, he had gone down right on Main Street in Kendrick. I think I could point the house to you right to this day. Anyway, he and his wife, I believe, obviously must have been a nurse or else some friend that knew the stilling business. I don't say his wife was even involved, and she was a wonderful person. Anyway, he put a sign on the door, smallpox, keep out. And he operated that thing for over 3 months with that sign on there. People really got suspicious. And you could actually smell, the brine, the cookings. And here he was manufacturing moonshine. And they caught him. And that was the end of Dr. Kelly. But I can remember the sign. I remember seeing it. And I thought nothing of it. But he left it there, too, of our. But he was a real bootlegger. But there were several from Troy that was caught bootlegging. Herb Spencer out here. Have you interviewed him?
No, I've talked to his brother, Jess. Should I talk to Herb too?
Herb, he was arrested. He was put in jail. They caught him. He was moonshined. Yes, and a hard working good man too. But he was one of the victims. Heck, you had to make him live in some way. So he did it. The McKeons were the big ones.
That's what I heard.
Old Sam McKeon, and he made good stuff. And they tried, he would just always one jump ahead of the goddamn revenueers. And he manufactured it, and he sold it. He had several boys. They were all in cahoots. And Sam, he made good stuff. But he was touchy. If he didn't know you, he would never sell to me because I was Frank Green's son-in-law. That was enough. I don't give a goddamn. I won't sell you nothing. I know Frank Green. I don't think his son-in-law should have it. That's just to be his attitude, see. But Herman Boyd, he was the old reliable. That's who I bought all mine from, virtually. Because he made wonderful stuff. You knew it was good. Did I ever tell you that a kid graduated from school up here. He graduated in May from high school, and I played against him in basketball. It was my first year in Troy. He had already been out, Wilford Johnson, and a great big guy. But anyway, I kept the books, besides the bank books, I kept the books for Sam Olson and Edwin Johansson. They had a garage across the street from the bank, so after banking hours, I would go over there and do the posting, post their ledgers, and send out the statements and so forth on their books. So I went over there probably 4:30 one afternoon, and here I went into their garage. They had a service station and they had a garage behind. And I walked in the door, and here was one, two, three, four. There was a good 8 men standing around, sitting on anything they could get up. Some of them were standing, and in the center on a apple box was a 5-gallon can, and that was full of moonshine. And it belonged to this Wilford Johnson. And they had given each one a sample, and he wanted to sell it. And that was so bad that there was only one guy that could even begin to drink it, and that was an alcoholic by the name of Eskel Gord. That's George Gord's brother. He would up that goddamn cup, and he would rush it around his mouth just like you would water and swallow. It wasn't good, but it wasn't bad. And he bought that whole 5-gallon for $5. And I saw that. And the rest of them, they wouldn't no more think of buying it than nothing, because it was poison to them. And of course, that man died eventually from his drinking. But he was a real moonshine drinking man. Eskel Gord never made any. He always bought it. And he was well to do, too. He was worth money.
Sam McKeon really has a fine.
Sam McKeon, he was a moonshiner, was the word go. And they caught him. They would keep picking him up on general principles. On us, they knew he was making it. They knew he was selling it. They knew he was peddling it. And they'd pick him up on the smallest charges. But he was clever, and he was good at it. I drank his stuff. It was good. But I never bought anything from him, though. As I say, he wouldn't have sold me nothing.
Was it usually the county sheriffs like Summerfield and
Hap Moody was the watchdog. See, Hap Moody worked under Summerfield. He was his deputy, and Hap Moody was, and so was Jordan. Moody was smart, and Jordan was nothing but a bull. I saw Jordan one day right out here. It was a dirt, it was a dirt road or whether it was gravel. It wasn't oiled. And it was right out here. And he stopped a young kid. And he suspicioned that he had whiskey in his car and that he was drunk. And it was a touring car, open, you know, open side. And I saw him pull the door open and grab that kid by the nape of the neck, by his shirt and the nape of the neck, and just lift him right out of the car and set him right out on the gravel. Mad, oh, and I, honest to goodness, I lost respect then for law and order. That kid, he never had nothing on him, nothing at all, but just because he may have had a little bit shady reputation, but he was going to just beat the hell out of that kid. He had asked him some questions, and he hadn't got the proper answer, he didn't think, and that's what he was going to do. But that kid was no more drunk than nothing. And he hadn't, and before he got through, the kid was back in the car and he drove off, and Jordan was still hollering or snorting like he would, like he did, you know. He had no good for anybody. He didn't have a good word for his own mother, I don't think. I never liked Jordan, and that incident made you really sick of him.
I've heard he was kind of the heavy.
Yes, he was the heavy, local. Yeah. Hap Moody was not that type. Hap Moody was he had a heart, he had a conscience. He was clever, though. He was smart. I tell you, he was just as good as any dog in the country and cracking down a still, and he had a lot of guts.
I've talked to him.
Yes.
He's told me about, a lot of times he would impersonate,
he would.
A lumberjack or something like that.
Yeah, you know, he'd go in the disguise, sure. Yeah, he no doubt was a very good undercover man.
So little, you wouldn't even think he was a
cop. Yeah, that's right, yeah. No, he was wiry, though. Yeah.
I suppose I should get going. Well, what time do you have there?
Oh, 4:45. Yeah.
Probably I should, because you have a pretty big...
Baseball was great in my day when I was still an eighth grader, you might say, or a seventh grader, because on the ridges, there was baseball in the backyard, in the cow lots, and in the Timothy fields. That was common. I had two cousins, and there was two of us, George and I, and Tony and Otto Eichner, and then we'd have Harry Amling, and you'd have Tim Wade. But even the four of us, we could have a ball game. Those two are our two cousins, and whenever we'd go to our aunts and uncles for dinner, we played baseball. And of course, the Eichner's father was quite an enthusiast. And so Moscow had a baseball team. They called it the Moscow Cubs. It was made up, and it was managed by a man by the name of Eastman. And Coney Estes was one. Frazier in Spokane, he was a player. I played against him. But anyway, we organized. We got nine ball players at Kendrick, and we off of American Ridge. And these Eichner boys were good. One of them could pitch. Otto was a pitcher, and he could throw a curve ball at you. And I was playing against that constantly, so I knew how to bat against I'm not bragging, because we all did. He threw a curve, and it'd come right at you, and then it would curve over the plate, and you'd be out here dodging, see? And he'd throw that in against these Cubs, and he had them scared to death, and they were just backing away from the plate, and he'd curve over and be strike. And in one game, they never got on to him. And Moscow had a pitcher, and he did the same thing. But we'd stand up there and watch the ball and curve, and I got up to bat four times, and every one of them, I was striking fast, see, and every one of them went over third base, and I got a hit, and we all did. We beat them. I think the score was 7-3, something like that, and we really got the reputation, because Moscow Cubs was really prominent. They had baseball suits. We went up there in our clothes, in our short pants or whatever it had, and on the way up, I'll never forget this. We stopped the train, it came through Kendrick at 9:00. We came through Troy, and we got to Moscow about 10, or between 10 and 11. We played in the afternoon, and then we got on the train, and we was back into Kendrick at 9:00 that night. That was the schedule. See, we had two trains a day, both ways. Anyway, we got to Troy, and we had only 8 players. And so we stuck our head out the window, and there was a kid on the platform over there, and we hollered at him, "Hey, can you play baseball?" He said, "Yeah, a little." He was skinny, and his name was Weeks. And I swear they had TB. He was that skinny. But, well, come on, you want to go to Moscow and play? We'll buy your ticket. And we got that kid on, and he went up there and played for us. That was the ninth player, believe it or not.
Was he any good?
Did he play? Oh, I can't. Sam, he just filled the spot. But the idea was, and knowing him after I came to Troy, I remembered him. I remembered him that well, and I kidded him about it. And so then you put two and two together, wondering, well, how in the Sam Hill? We hollered at you. Didn't your parents miss you? And you get up here and you find out his background. He wasn't home whenever he wanted to go home. He was kind of a rounder and a troubled kid, and so he fell right in line. But he swear, I still think it's Merle Weeks out here. That's the same kid. He works for the University of Idaho. No, he works for Washburn Wilson Seed now. But I think he's the same one. It either has to be that, or else it was Vernon. It was one of those kids. And they were just little devils at that time. But we went up there and we won that game.
Well, how regular did you have? Did you have a regular team?
Well, we played every Sunday among ourselves. But the following year, we only played the Moscow Cubs once then, because it was so hard to get there. But they come down after that. They were so impressed with this Eichner pitching, and his brother was good at everything too. And they came down every Sunday, and they got this because they wanted to give this boy an opportunity, Otto. He was that good at pitching because he had a fabulous curve. And that they took him, and he joined the Cub team, he and his brother. And of course, our dad died that winter, so we were out. And so there was no more baseball for us then. But they did, they really, and then Otto died the following year. He got pneumonia.
Otto Eichner?
Mm-hmm, he died. It was either pneumonia or else, as I recall, I think it was a bursted appendix. And they put him on the train in Kendrick and they took him to Moscow and he died during the operation. And that was the last of Otto. But Tony became quite an outstanding ball player. He played for Ritzville, he played for Moscow, he played for Genesee. He was in demand too. He was a good little ball player. He could have, had he have ever followed it, I think he could have made big lead, but he was so small. He was a small guy, but of course size was no big issue in those days if you were good. But he didn't pitch and he didn't catch, but he played outfield and he played, I think he played shortstop because he's regular, but he's pretty good at the bat.
I was going to ask you if Kendrick and Troy, when you were growing up, if they had like days like, well, not baseball, I'm thinking of celebration days. Like, did
yes.
they have like
the Yeah, they'd
July?
Have a 4th of July, yeah. Not very often. It got to be such a chore, you know. The celebrations were fantastic. When you did put on a 4th of July, it was really spontaneous, large. They'd have speakers, you know. Politicians would come there, and the entertainment would be throwing at the nigger babies. And I can recall, I think I wrote that in that thing that I wrote up. We went to Moscow to a 4th of July. It was either 4th of July or a county fair. Probably it was I don't know which one, whether it was a 4th of July or the county fair. Anyway, my dad and all of us kids, Kenneth, I don't think he was even born then, but there was four of us kids, three boys and one girl, and mother and dad, and we got on the train in Kendrick at 9 o'clock in the morning, and we went to Moscow to the fair. And my biggest impression was when I had my dad stood beside me, and we watched the people throw at a nigger behind a curtain. He was behind a canvas, and his head stuck through the hole. His hands were behind, just his head was out. And they threw baseballs at him. I would say that they threw as far as from here to the kitchen. That'd be that much. He never got hit. But ever so often, you could get eggs instead of the balls if you wanted to pay more money. See, that was supposed to be more fun, to throw a rotten egg at him. That's what they called it. For three for a quarter, rotten eggs. Otherwise, the baseballs was maybe three for a dime because there was no loss there, but the eggs were gone. And then they'd throw eggs at him every so often, see. You get somebody would give him a quarter, well, he could have eggs to throw. And I felt so sorry for that boy, and it made me sick, see. And just to watch it, the expression on my face must have been something, as I think about it now. because
what about the expression on his face?
Oh, he was having the time of his life.
He was enjoying
it. Sure. Huh? No, he was being paid for it. But he was hollered. He'd holler at them, and they'd call him, "You dirty black son of a bitch," you know, and this and that. No women around. Women would be away from it. But the men were having the time of their lives. And he was, too, you know. He dodged. They never hit him, only with the eggs. The eggs would break, right, say, maybe that far from him, and they'd splash in his face. He didn't care. He was, I don't know what he got, but it was just the idea to me.
Yeah.
And I never forgot it. Isn't that funny?
Yeah, it sounds.
And in those days, nothing taught in our school. We never did see a Negro. There was as rare as chickens, you know. We never saw a Negro. We saw a lot of Indians because we were in an Indian area. And we had a Chinese man in Kendrick who lived there, Gene Chinaman. Yeah.
Well, I'd never met him before.
Is that right?
Yeah.
He was a vegetable gardener. He had his garden. My dad, we never went by his house, but what we would stop, and he'd come out, or he'd be crossing the street, and Dad had talked to him, and he liked us because we were boys, Chinese. They had no use for girls, and he would tell Dad that. Oh, me no like you girly. But I take those boys anytime. You want to leave them here, you go ahead. And of course, Dad would get a kick out of that, see. And we'd be a little bit scared, but we weren't, as long as we were with him, we knew we were safe. But he would talk. He was just a kind, old, clean gentleman. And he lived for, after we moved to Kendrick, I've been in his house, in his shack, as you might say, no more than a small, I'd say it wasn't as large as that garage. His home, cool, but warm and comfortable, clean. There was a kitchen and a bed. Everything was in this room. And he had a wood floor, but
lived all by himself.
Lived all by himself.
No other Chinese people there.
No, never. He had. I don't think he ever even had a visitor.
Did he have a good garden?
Yes, fabulous. And he'd wheel it uptown. He'd put it in a two-wheel cart, and he was constantly, as the stuff would come ripe, he'd deliver it to the stores. You never bought direct from him, unless if you wanted to, fine. But he patronized the stores because he sold to the stores, and the stores would sell to customers. And so he would never, I don't know whether, we never did, and I don't know whether anybody ever would stop and buy direct from him, because I think the stores took everything he had. And they liked it that way, see, then they got to sell it and make the profit on it. But he would raise cabbages, corn, tomatoes, not too much cantaloupe or watermelons. I don't think he did that at all. He was, I can just see his garden right across the street from where he lived.
I wonder if he rented it.
No, he was on, well, the garden, I don't know what deal he had there, because it was...
It's pretty tough for them to buy land, Chinese.
Yes, and the fact that nobody wanted this because water would set in it pretty late in the spring, so you didn't build a house there. There was no dwellings close to it. And I think that was the reason that how he happened to get it, and he knew how to farm wet land.
With water, huh?
Mm-hmm. And his house was on the railroad right-of-way, so nobody could touch him. Yeah, see, if you go down to Kendrick, where the Brocky warehouses, that's on railroad right away, and you get down there to where that road, where you hit Kendrick and that road comes in, all those houses on there are on NP railroad right away.
Huh.
Yeah, they pay so much a year. It's personal property. All they can sell, if they ever sell, is their house. They can't sell a lot.
So he stayed there for quite a while.
Well, he was there. Gene Chinaman, I'd say, was obviously there 20, 25 years. Because he was old when my dad still lived, and he died after I came to Troy, I'm sure, which would have been early in the late 20s. I don't think he was even alive during the Depression. Kenny would probably know, my brother, how long he actually lived. I don't know, but he was an old man in 1918, and that's when my dad was alive, and we saw him because he was slow. And he was just an older man, period. But he was a Chinaman.
A lot of those people always planned on going back to China and never
did. Yeah, but I don't know how he got there. I don't know. You never, Nobody questioned him. Nobody visited him. I think kids were afraid that Gene Chinaman would chop your ears off. And he didn't want kids to hang around him, you know, because they never molested him, never broke his windows, and never stole from him. And at night, you wouldn't even think of going near there. In the daytime, why, he had nothing. You weren't at ease. After I got old enough, when I was in high school, as I say, I'd go down there and walk in and talk to him. He was glad to have me. But he knew me, too, because he remembered me. He remembered my dad.
Remembered you for growing up.
Yeah, so but I never did anything for him, and he never asked me to do. I was so young, you know, I was still in high school.
But you get the idea he really didn't have much to do with people.
No, he didn't, and that was for sure, yes. In fact, I don't even know what happened to him after he became ill and died. I don't know where he's buried. I have no idea. I never even gave it a thought. You know, he was just a forgotten man.
Because a lot of them really wanted to go back to be buried in China.
I would imagine. And he obviously had to have money because he was so frugal. And other than his salt and his pepper and his flour, and I'll bet you he didn't buy anything. You know, his cost of his garden, which was always fabulous. Oh, he had a fantastic garden. Unbelievable. He really could raise. He knew how. He didn't give it away. He always sold it. And the merchants would cater to him because they wanted him. It was good.
They sent, from what I've learned from talking to this older Chinese couple, they sent the money back to China much of the time because the families were really poor, and that's why they were here, because they could make some money here and send them back. And if you had somebody in your family here and they were making money, you were pretty
well expected off. I think that's true in the Jews too. I think they do that yet. I don't think there's any question that we're keeping Israel just on general principle. You know, and I never knew to this day. I don't know what Gene Chinaman's name was. That's all I ever heard, was Gene Chinaman. Yeah, obviously his name was Gene, and the Chinaman was picked on because that's what everybody called him. Nobody ever said Gene, nobody ever said Chinaman. That's Gene Chinaman. Isn't that funny?
Yeah.
But now that we talk about it, I knew so much about him and heard him tell Herman Paulson, tell about other people. And for some reason or other, I remember it. Which makes history to me very interesting.
Right. Well, that's the only link that there is.
That's
that
right.
People who remember.
No, but every year they're dropping off, and for some reason or other, there's a gap. There's a gap between real old and those out of us that don't think we're old. See. And there's just like this Jenny Driscoll. I think you're gonna. I don't want you to do it because I think you're gonna be amazed. And if you just, and I told her, he's not going to write. You just talk. You just forget that he's there. And you just ramble on. You can tell him anything you want. But those incidents, like you tell about riding that horse, those are things that are going to take the attraction. That's going to make people laugh and think of, well, that maybe happened to them. And I said, you go home now and you think about it. And I'll get Sam there just as quick as we can. And she says, okay. But she says, I'm afraid it might be disappointing. Well, it won't. And she walked took her 3 hours to go to school, to walk to school. And that's something else that should be brought out.
Yeah, I mean, 20 years ago, it would have been fantastic.
Oh, man, there was so much history then. Yes, sir. So I think you've got the ball rolling. For goodness sake, don't let it stop.
Yeah, I'm figuring on...